Hi, and welcome to Cine Nation, a new podcast brought to you by The Media Machine, and I am Brandon Sparks. I'm here with Ben Gertz.
Howdy.
Ben is in Portland, Oregon right now, and I am in Los Angeles. So we're here today. The past few episodes, we've talked a little bit about Netflix and streaming and how this is changing the modern film industry as we know it. And so it got me thinking, what have been some previous movies that have changed are the modern film industry, the modern like mainstream industry. And so I remember a few
Hollywood
specifically. And we'll delve into more things, but Hollywood specifically. So there was a list back in a few years ago that Entertainment Weekly did that listed the 10 movies that changed Hollywood. And it goes like this. It was Hoop Dreams, Pulp Fiction, Clerks, Toy Story, Billy Madison, Blair Witch Project, The Matrix, Memento, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Ocean's 11.
I'm not trying to start off in a contentious mode, but like this totally feels like a BuzzFeed top 10 list.
I don't really like. There's a few of those I get, and some of them I don't. But I remember reading this in Entertainment Weekly when I got my issue. It was, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but I was like, these movies? These are the ones that changed, and a few of them I will agree with. But before these movies, there are ones that kind of affected Hollywood a lot more. And the first one that really changed it was Jaws. Jaws was a film before Jaws, and we have a number of articles that we'll post in the notes of each of these films regarding how they changed the industry. And Jaws was one, it was the first big summer blockbuster. And it was in 1975, and surprisingly before then, studios didn't actually release films in the summer because it was hot.
Well, they didn't release good films. Big films that they wanted to make money on. It was a dumping ground.
It's kind of like how January and February are nowadays. The summer was that because they pretty much thought in the 30s and 40s and even the 50s, they didn't think people would go to the theater for 2 hours a day in the hot atmosphere that it was in the summer. And then finally, theaters started to get air conditioning, and they realized, hey, there's actually a market for a younger audience or audiences in general to release big blockbuster films. But also at that point, they weren't releasing films on the same day everywhere. It was the limited release style of like a couple theaters here, and it slowly expanded. Well, the first one that kind of did it actually was not Jaws, it was The Godfather. And The Godfather released in about 300 theaters, and that was the most it ever released in one day. And
That's interesting.
It's credited to Jaws, but Godfather did it first. The big thing about Jaws was that they learned how to use marketing to promote their film. Basically, what happened was they realized they could actually buy, a few days before the release date, they bought advertising on television. And at this point, studios actually did not advertise on TV. They didn't see the point, and it cost too much money. Well, when they released Jaws, they decided to buy a number of 30-second spots in primetime television a few days before the release. It opened in 465 theaters in one day, which to us nowadays isn't that big at all, because you had something like, say, Avengers 2 probably opened up in over 4,000 theaters in one day in this country, and that was 465.
This is a good turning point where the expense of a film or the release of a film shifts from, you know, it's like, why are you not rolling it out everywhere? Well, yeah. You know, you got to make a whole bunch of prints simultaneously for no real good reason, when you could just make a run of a couple prints and cycle them around the country, and it's like a library book you just loan around to people, right? But if you shift it and spend more on the marketing, well, now you got to get more bang out of your marketing dollars, so you open to a broader market by your TV spend. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you see these massive, you know, the huge expense now for some of these really big summer blockbuster films isn't necessarily the film itself. I mean, although they are expensive,
yes,
the marketing blitzes that they'll do can be, you know, substantially more than the film, because, I mean, you know, they're on like Mountain Dew bottles, and yeah. you know, they're doing these massive cross promotions that take a long time to set up and produce and manage, and so you have to have this fixed time where everything can focus in and get your money back.
Yeah, and yeah. Regarding that, like nowadays, when I look at a budget for a Hollywood film, like say it's $200 million, I usually at least double that when adding marketing. I think marketing is just yeah. is just as like a big studio will spend just as much marketing a movie as they will actually making the movie.
That's what they told us in film school, was you basically have to take double for prints and advertising.
Yes, exactly. Which is kind of like, it's insane. And because that was the whole thing was interesting, we'll go back and kind of what we talked about last week or past few weeks, is Snowpiercer, what they did on video on demand, they couldn't afford a marketing campaign. So instead they released on video on demand, and that actually became a marketing campaign to some degree, because some people went to go see it in theaters, but they also like they had to see it because it was on video on demand. It was this big film with these big stars, but it really was just a small film that didn't have enough money to actually market the film itself.
But another thing to remember too, that's going to come up throughout a lot of our discussions here, is they benefited a lot from the marketing or the buzz around the way they marketed. Yes. You know what I mean? There were articles written about, oh, look, it's VOD and it's in theaters
at the same time, same day.
Yeah, and so like they get that free press.
Yeah,
kind of like Beats Headphones is really clever about, like, you know, the NFL bans Beats, so you know players still wear them, get fined from the NFL for violating the league rules, and then Beats reimburse the player for the $10,000 fine. It's clearly a great buy. You know, for Beats to spend $10,000 to get hundreds of articles and ESPN time showing yeah. Colin Kaepernick wearing, you know, illegal, you know,
yeah, how
Beats headphones that he's not supposed to wear. It's great.
How these big football superstars will literally break the rules because they love the headphones so much. And that's...
Well, but it's great marketing.
Exactly.
It's like that, and that's the similar thing, is like... It, you know, you can either create your own news stories, mm-hmm. right, that you get for free, or you have to spend to convince people to read your ad, basically,
yeah.
right? And so it's like, if you can do something newsworthy, then you get free advertising,
yeah,
right? And that's something that will come up in some of these other stories we're talking about,
yeah.
or other films, is that, you know, if you don't have something really interesting to say, you're probably going to have to spend a ton of money to
yes.
interrupt people's day with an advertisement.
Yes.
But if you have an interesting... unique new thing, people are curious, people want to know, people want to see it.
Going off of what we're talking about, is the good transition, I think, is the 1989 film Batman we're talking about. I know it's crazy, but it's what I'm going to ask, because Jaws was the first big summer blockbuster, and Batman, it drew a lot of, when they announced the director, when they announced Tim Burton, who wasn't really known at the time, he was known for like crazy comedies with like Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. I'll be honest with you, if I heard that the director of Pee-wee's Big Adventure is directing Batman, I would probably be upset as well. And then they had Michael Keaton, who was known for...
Well, just remember, there's a similar outrage right now about Ben Affleck.
Exactly. That draws comparisons to that, because Michael Keaton, who was casted as Bruce
right.
Wayne back then, he was known as just comedy roles. People were so upset, they were sending in letters to Warner Brothers, studying how these are two horrible choices.
Wasn't it like 50,000 letters or something
yeah.
that article said?
It's like...
It's some ridiculous... I know letters were different back then,
yeah.
but like, I have to be... I don't know that I've sent an angry letter. You know what I mean? Like, and I've been mad about a lot of things. So to get to the point where you write an angry letter in mass, like 50,000 people, that is just crazy talk.
Because you're upset that someone got casted as Batman.
Yeah, I mean, that is wild to imagine.
It's crazy. But what Batman did was, Warner Brothers, they realized, hey, they actually took that with Tim Burton and Michael Keaton and used that to their advantage. They decided to release, I think IGN and FlavorWire both talk about it, they decided to release a teaser trailer. About a minute and a half, and when you watch it, it is one of the worst cut trailers I've ever seen before in my life. You can hear the audio.
No, what you mean is that the film is one of the worst.
No. Oh, I love the film. I will state right now on the record that Michael Keaton is the best Batman to me. hands down. Christian,
I will state right now that I have not watched the film. I'm throwing myself under the bus because I just don't like the 80s, and this seems like the pinnacle of just terrible yeah. 80s films. Well, I'm sorry.
I love
that. Unsubscribe to the podcast if you think I'm, you know.
I love that Batman. I'm not saying it's better than Nolan's Batman's. I'm not saying that. Yeah. I think Michael Keaton is the best overall Batman package that we've seen so far. Christian Bale is by far the best Bruce Wayne, because to me there's a difference.
Let's split those hairs, Brandon. Let's get into that.
let's not. Anyway, back to what I'm talking about. They released a teaser trailer because they wanted to show, hey, this is the Batman we're releasing. It's dark, it's edgy, it's gritty. And at that point, it was kind of crazy. Like, people didn't expect that. And it was literally just like snippets of stuff they'd shot. And this is 6 months before the release came out. And it wasn't the first teaser trailer, but it was one of the biggest that happened, apparently. It's in FlavorWire.com, it says that in this pre-internet age, word was that Batman fans were actually buying tickets to movies they didn't even want to see just to look at the teaser trailer. And then once the teaser was over, they'd leave and waste their money, essentially, on buying that ticket just to see this minute and a half trailer, which is really insane. But that had really never, ever happened before. And nowadays, we have teaser trailers every week. Sometimes we have teasers of the teaser trailer. Like every big film nowadays, like, here's 15 seconds of the minute and a half teaser trailer for Captain America 2. And I'm like, we're teasing the actual teaser, which is crazy to me.
Well, they're just trying to build any hype they can build. But I already threw myself under the bus and said I haven't seen the film, but I did watch some of the clips that you sent, mm-hmm. and I've seen pieces of it, and I would like to watch Jack Nicholson. Yeah, right, I'm not an idiot. Yeah. I think I would enjoy that. But the other piece that was really interesting from the articles is this idea, like you said, of the teaser and showing that. It's a cartoon, or not? It's a comic character.
Yeah.
Right? It's a story from a comic, but it's told in this really dark, kind of dystopian sort of world, and yes. that was what was unique for the time.
Yes,
and that was what people were not expecting from Burton.
Yes,
and from Keaton.
And because at that point the audiences in America were used to the superhero movie before Batman was Superman, and Superman was really, to me, lighthearted compared to Batman. And what happened, too, with Batman was that they marketed the film. It was a movie that it wasn't a sequel, and it was being marketed more like it was a big blockbuster sequel at the time, and it wasn't. And they had stuff on cereal. They had merchandising before the movie ever came out. Usually it happened after the fact. Like, they made money, almost made profit, just from the merchandising alone before the movie ever hit theaters. It essentially, like, at the time, it made... Opening weekend, it made $40.4 million, according to the IGN article that we have. And it doesn't seem like much compared to nowadays. From inflation, it'd be $77.5 million today. That was the biggest opening, I think, by far, any movie had ever had. Basically, and this is actually kind of a bad thing, I'll admit, is that Batman turned box office week, the first box office weekend is the most important weekend for that film. We were used to films slowly growing over time and making, like, Jaws, like, top ranking box office-wise, like, beat the record in 75 days. Like, nowadays, a film could, if it's trying to get, like, $100 million opening weekend. And this is a film that, like, since Batman, every studio now tries to, okay, opening weekend is the most important thing, and so they really shoot for opening weekend numbers to be, like, sky high. And so it's not about making money over time. So Batman, the sad thing about the studios learned was that, hey, we need to create these big, or have franchises that can make money instantly.
It's the tentpole strategy yeah. that everyone has been kind of railing against the past
yes.
5-6 years as we keep getting more and more and more of them.
Yes.
And, you know, they build the tent pole, I guess, or the, you mm-hmm. know, the size of the film becomes so huge and they become so dependent on that opening weekend.
Yes.
That it is, you know, people have raised questions of, like, okay, when is the big flop coming that will undermine this strategy? You know, because you can't all have, because ticket sales are in decline.
Yes.
Right. The box office numbers are still decent, but that's because they're raising prices and doing 3D and all these different things.
Yeah.
But ticket sales cumulatively are in decline. And so, you know, there's just, they're carving up the same pie and it's shrinking.
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, you look nowadays, you have films, like, you have things come out like John Carter that probably cost over $400 million or more for production and marketing, and it made like 200. The reported loss, Disney said it was, they lost around $400 million from John Carter. But, and they did the Lone Ranger, which also was kind of the same way. And both those were the big Hollywood tentpole movies that were going to start franchises, and they ended up doing nothing. But, and then now we're going to backtrack a bit, because Batman was the one that kind of did it. The opening weekend, they established the opening weekend, how it showed that you could actually make money in a short amount of time, which had never happened before. The big one to me that probably affects everything, it's kind of the cliche one, is Star Wars. Because Star Wars, before the release, wasn't big at all. No one knew what it was. And in reality, seriously, no one would actually buy the picture. Like, George Lucas did American Graffiti, and it made a lot of money. And Universal was like, hey, we'll do whatever film you have next. We will do it. Like, you can pick whatever you want to. And he went to him with this space opera about some droids or whatever. Like, yeah, we'll do anything but that. And no one thought it was going to be a huge thing. And then it's this huge, massive hit. And that kind of changed everything. It changed. And Lucas was, this is Lucas' best deal he's ever made before in his life. And it was that he had full control over merchandising. It wasn't Fox. He had full control over. He basically could get, he got the profit from merchandising. He had full, total control. Yeah, not just
control.
That.
He got the dollar bills.
He got the dollar bills.
All those dollar bills.
He's made more money off of merchandising for Star Wars than the actual films themselves. That's insane to me. Star Wars, the time, there's an article we have from Time Magazine, The 10 Ways Star Wars Changed the Movie Industry. They list like the or Hollywood's notion of the mass audience, like what they're wanting. It changed what kind of movies are made. An interesting part that people kind of forget is it changed the way movies sound. Movies like...
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. That changed technologically of how sound is developed for films.
I think that's a big thing about Lucas, right? I mean, it's THX, it's ILM.
Yes.
You know, it's ultimately what was originally Pixar and then sold to Steve Jobs later. I mean, he had a great understanding of all of the technology in the process, and maybe that's in some ways kind of the downfall of some of the more recent Star Wars that he did, right? But at that time, you know, those were big jumps. Like, the jump from mono sound in theaters to THX is mind-boggling, right? And same with the work that ILM was doing. I mean, those are game-changing effects when you put this list together and I was looking through it, I mean, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey, clearly, you know, there's that great review from Ebert talking about the first time he saw 2001 Space Odyssey, like, I don't know, it's something like he was in France and they were projecting it along the river or something, you know, it was like this, I mean, you know, he's biased, I think, partially by how he saw it first, but but just talking about when he saw the visual effects of that film, which, you know, laid the groundwork in some ways for what people wanted to see.
Yes.
Although the Star Wars definitely tops it in a lot of ways, technically. You know, it's just this moving experience for people who've never experienced it, right? I mean, space is just such a perfect place for these advancements in imagery, because it's like, it's not like we're sending cameras out to film this stuff before. This is a whole new canvas in which to tell stories, you know, even though it's a space opera and it's not, you know, whatever, it's a new world that people got to see in theaters, and it's a big picture movie that you want to see and hear in full THX, and, you know, the whole thing, it's really clever, and clearly it's, you know, wildly successful, so nothing I'm gonna say is gonna, you know.
But yeah, with Star Wars, it really changed, like in this article it talks about how it changed the Hollywood power structure, and it introduced the things like movie merchandising and how much you can make off of that, which studios thinking, okay, we need a franchise that we can make money off of, not just through films, but through the toy sales or through...
They're just trying to diversify their revenue streams. They're trying to reduce risk so that they can make more of these movies. You know, it's like... There was I heard something from John Lasseter, I think, about or a story about Lasseter talking about Cars 2, you know, because like I've had to watch Cars and Cars 2 because, you know, repeatedly, because my son wakes up in the morning, he's like, car, 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 car. So of course, you know, we don't do it every day, clearly, that would be crazy. But for a while there, we had a run where we were watching Cars, and he doesn't care about which one it is, right? Car, Cars 2. But clearly, like, Cars 2 is not the best Pixar movie. It's pretty weak in many places. But one of the things that I heard Lasseter say is that, like, you know, it's not always about taking these huge risks to, like, you know, tell an innovative story that we've never seen before,
mm-hmm.
because you do have to think about, like, the health of the company. You know, this is kind of corporate from someone people worship like John Lasseter, but it's like, they were thinking about Cars 2 because it extended the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
They were able, you know, they're owned by Disney at that point, so they're thinking about theme park rides that they can make from it, and new characters they can sell, you know, merchandising. And so it's like, it's a practical decision for them to make Cars 2. It's not a great film, it's not the worst film, but it was extremely profitable for them.
Oh,
you know, they got to reuse a ton of... That's what's going on. You know, it's sad is too strong. That's all I'm pushing back on.
Okay.
And it doesn't make the best films, but it keeps these companies alive to make more films.
I think one thing that someone said one time, it was like, they make these big, some studios, not all, but some studios make these big, huge film, these big, huge tentpole films, because that gives them enough money to make those five small films that are more... like, are more in line with what people kind of... well, not more in line with what people want, but, like, are the more personal, smaller, like, not intimate, because it's not independent, in my opinion, but smaller
films. Well, the prestige films, right? It's like, you're not gonna make a ton of money on Oscar-worthy films, typically, right? I mean, you know, there's a rabid fan base of cinephiles, people who want to see these great works of art, mm-hmm. right? But... you know, just like in any art form, is like, you know, it's just, there's not going to be a ton of money there. Those are the projects of love that people do and don't make a ton of money, but it's what moves the craft forward in some ways, like, you know, at a personal level or whatever. People work all their lives to be able to make those sorts of projects.
Yeah.
But from a business, and this is clear, Hollywood definitely is a business. They're doing a couple Ocean's 11s to pay off all of Soderbergh's other nonsense. You know what I mean? And I like Soderbergh, so nonsense is too strong. But
yeah, Soderbergh is interesting. Just, he's one of those guys who can kind of toe the line of independent and studio, because he's done both.
And he can quit too. I don't know. I'm sure you've seen his. I quit films.
He can quit whenever he wants to. He says he's quitting, but he keeps. I mean, he's DPing Magic Mike 2. So I mean, he's not quitting entirely. I mean, he just did The Nick with Clive Owen. It's a TV show that he directed.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of TV now, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he's jumping on this golden age of television, raking in some more dollars. But anyway, yeah, I'm getting you off track now.
Let's
can name drop, you know, Coppola, Soderbergh, and then I'll throw you off track forever.
Thank you. But no, with Star Wars, it was one that did the whole merchandising and this, and then turning the theme park rides in the 80s and 90s, or the 90s, and Lucas could do whatever he wanted to. So what he did was, he founded a company, ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and he created a small research company to find new ways to edit sound and sound effects and to make composite effect shots. Essentially, that company was Pixar. With the money from Star Wars, Lucas was able to create Pixar and ILM. And then ILM is still one of the biggest visual effects places.
Well, another thing that's interesting about what he did with his money, right, is that like his peers, you know, Spielberg, Coppola, right, they turn around and they invest in other filmmakers to make films, right? But Lucas really set out to change the underlying technologies.
Yes.
Or more accurately, I guess, move those forward.
Yes.
You know, so advancements in sound, advancements in special effects, advancements in graphics that ultimately become Pixar, you know.
Yes.
And so it's interesting because it's a different, they played different ways. Lucas ended up making more money and probably changed the direction of what we consider Hollywood, because in a lot of ways what makes a Hollywood film that goes international, you know, are these massive effects, you know, the ILM style, you know, blockbuster effects. And so it's like, between him and Spielberg, you know, I mean, they've really kind of defined that, like, blockbuster, summertime, big Hollywood movie. Like,
that leads us to kind of two other films, Toy Story and Jurassic Park. And Toy Story was 95, I believe. And that was the first, like, computer animated film. But I remember when that movie came out. And an article online will post, they said that Toy Story showed that computer animation was faster and cheaper than traditional animation. And it goes, in an article about the film, Entertainment Weekly noted that Toy Story required 3/4 the budget and 1/8 of the animation staff compared to Lion King, which premiered a year before and became the biggest, like, highest grossing animated film at that time. So it was cheaper and faster for Toy Story, and then it was a new type of aesthetic, I guess you could say, a new type of, like, way to tell a story.
Well, and that, and there's a great podcast called The Incomparables, which we'll have to link to, and they break, they dive down into these individual films, in depth, and I was just listening to their Toy Story one this morning, actually, and it's excellent, and one of the key things that they talk about early in the podcast is, that it opened up cinematic language for animation films that was not available with traditional animation. It was so overly complex.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about the opening sequence where Andy's swinging the toys around in his chair.
Yeah.
You have that POV and how incredibly complex all of those different shadows and the change of perspective and all these things that would be really, really difficult. The example that they use is that ballroom dance sequence in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
That was partially computer animated, and that was a huge deal at the time for that.
Yeah.
But here's Toy Story, doing it completely and very early in the film, just to basically quote, The Incomparables, saying that this is not an animated film, this is cinema. This is language that you see in live action, as far as camera movement and camera placement and things like that.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting to think along those lines about it as well. It didn't just take traditional animation and all of a sudden make it computer. It really is this blending.
It's
live action.
Yeah. It was a new form of telling a story. And what's interesting, why I say Toy Story kind of changed it, because it was computer animated. Nowadays, I mean, even the Disney films, I think, are now all computer animated films. Like, they still draw stuff, but, like, when you look at things like Tangled and Frozen, those are all Wreck-It Ralph. Like, those are all computer animated films. It's not hand drawn anymore. I think there's still probably some hand drawing, but there's so much now. Like, the computer animation part is so important to the animation industry as a whole. But going off of computer animation, the other thing was Industrial Light and Magic, and you have to talk about Jurassic Park. We watched a video that the Academy Motion Picture of Art and Sciences did.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great watch. Excellent.
Yeah, we'll post that. They have another one that we'll talk about later, but it's basically it talks about how Steven Spielberg, he wanted to do all practical effects, and then the other effects he couldn't get, he wanted to have stop motion dinosaurs. And these guys at ILM, who had been really working on visual effects, they went under the radar without telling anyone and started creating the T-Rex.
They went rogue. They went against what they were told to do, and I love it. I love that part of the story.
They went against it. They're like, I think we can really do this. We think the industry's going to change. We've known this for a few years. Let's just do it. It's the perfect time to do it. Because they had been doing it with a few films before, like Terminator 2, Judgment Day, with James Cameron, which is another name you have to toss in the hat of, like, a director who's pushed technology in film. But Terminator 2, The Abyss was another one. And basically, it was just so funny. The guy who was in the video who kind of created the T-Rex, Kathleen Kennedy, and I think Frank Marshall, two producers of Jurassic Park, who were Spielberg's, like, his producing duo, he knew they were coming up to his office. And so he put it on the monitor for them to see. And they were like, oh my God, like, this can be, like, this is fluid and you can show it. And you can put this in a movie. And they show it to Spielberg, and Spielberg's like, yeah, we can do it. They essentially tell the guy who's been hired to do stop motion, yeah, we don't need you anymore. And
They still kept him around.
They still kept him around as a consultant. But what's interesting is that
some loyalty.
What these guys realized and what everyone else realized when they did it was, oh, this industry's changing and we gotta figure out ways to keep up. Because Stan Winston, who is like this, is a genius special effects, but practical effects guy. He did the Terminator robot, and he also did the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. Like it says, like after he watched the video, he went away for a half hour and talked to no one and saw no one. And they think it was because he was so shocked at what he saw. And so Jurassic Park, I think it's Jurassic Park's a film that still holds up to this day, in my opinion. Like, those type films that we're kind of talking about, Star Wars, it's almost like, what was it like to see that in the theater for the first time?
Well, I'm going to segue since we're getting up on time, and I'm going to say Avatar. I'm going to say, you know, what was it like to see Avatar in theater for the first time? And I know there's a lot of hate out there on Avatar from some people, but, you know, 3D, and when you really learn about how they made it, you know, the actual production process, that is fundamentally revolutionary to the green screen motion capture acting directing process of making a film like that. They did so many things that were absolutely groundbreaking to make that happen. And I think it translates to the screen in making it more interesting, more visually stunning. You know, I liked it. No. I know a lot of people, you know, oh, James Cameron, it's overblown. There's a reason that movie made a ton and a ton and a ton of money.
There is.
And that it's not necessarily like the script or the dialogue or the story necessarily. But those are not as bad as people say. But visually, it is stunning. It just is. And so I want to throw this on the table to you, Brandon, because it's like, I think that our premise is in the right direction in that, you know, these films changed the industry, right?
Yes.
Or changed Hollywood.
Changed Hollywood.
But in a way, every good film, like every film that succeeds in some way, is in some small way changing the industry, right? Because as you see success, other people try and follow. And really, what we're really talking about is, okay, what are some of the best examples of films that changed the industry? True. But a lot of films, you know, because you just mentioned with the Jurassic Park thing, it was like, okay, you know, Terminator, like all of these ILM films, especially from those early days, and Pixar, every Pixar film, when you really look at the behind the scenes when they talk about it, they're trying to do something that hasn't been done before. So like in Monsters, Inc., you know, they're trying to do the hair on the monsters, right? They're trying to do particle systems for hair. But I mean, you know, in some small way, the whole purpose of so much of this, of what we do, or what, maybe we is too strong here, I don't know, but what the industry is working towards, is you're always trying to push it forward in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You're always trying to find some new way, not as a gimmick, but as a way to move the language forward, to move the process forward, you know? And so that's my, I guess, sales pitch for the industry. I don't know. It's like, that's why I'm involved. I'm always trying to find those things for myself. And so that's what's interesting to see. Some of these are technology, some of these are marketing, some of these are storytelling, because we haven't even really gotten into Blair Witch or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, each of them find their own little, you know, trick or thing that works really, really well. And so that's why we're talking about it. But a lot of films are, you know, in some small way doing something clever that we're kind of all looking at.
Yeah, I guess a better way of saying it, it's not a change, more of a shift. There's a shift in the industry, because every one of these cause somewhat of a shift. I mean, you could say shift and change the same thing, but it's
watershed moments.
Yeah, watershed moments. Because like there were things that led up to it, but these are the movies that pushed it in that direction. So let's kind of skim
turning points.
Yeah, turning point. So yeah, you had Jurassic Park. A few other ones. I'm a list. We're gonna talk about real quick, because this is. Pulp Fiction's one that everyone talks about. I would agree with Pulp Fiction because the way the storytelling method was. I know some people.
I know. I've already outed myself for not seeing Batman. I'm not a Tarantino guy, and I know no one cares that I don't like it. I respect the film, like you said, for the way it's told.
Yes.
I don't think, if you dig into, like, talking about, you know, films that are precursors, there's quite a few films before. I mean, Pulp Fiction is the best You could definitely say for that time period, in the way that it's told, it's not the first by any means to tell a nonlinear story.
Oh, no. Who, I mean, Citizen Kane is a nonlinear
story. And I know you're not claiming that. I'm punching a straw man. I know that.
Yeah, no. Well, basically, I guess it's Pulp Fiction was right for the time, if that makes sense. It came in at the right moment.
Yeah.
And a quote we have, I think it was a BBC article, it talks about Tarantino. What kind of effect, and this is kind of how, this sums up Tarantino to me, plain and simple. And it goes, he drew from a lot of influences that were already out there, foreign cinema and niche filmmaking. But to audiences, it was the way he had compiled it together. People had never seen that before. That's Tarantino's career in a nutshell to me. Like, every film he's done, he's taken from the films that he watched growing up and working at the video store he worked at for years and just kind of created his own voice. But at that point, it was a shift.
Yeah, the video store thing is the key element in story of Tarantino. Yes. I mean, as soon as I found that out, that he worked at a video store and he just constantly watched movies, I mean, that tells it to, you know, for me, is that he's a blender. He's a blender of ideas, and he's, in a way, you know, we see it a lot more now with the internet, because everybody, anytime someone releases something on Vimeo or YouTube or whatever, I mean, it gets, that becomes the style very quickly. It propagates through the community, and the language changes very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, pre-Netflix streaming and pre-whatever, you know, like, if you worked at a video store, you really did have kind of like, and a good video store, you had kind of privileged access to a ton of movies, and he's, you know, he's the pinnacle of that, right? This cross-contamination of all these different things that aren't meant to be together, and he makes them work. I'll give it, you know, amazing dialogue, great structure, tons of references, just not for me. The violence, I'm just not.
A lot of people said about Tarantino and Tarantino's films, why that was kind of a shift for the industry was because it was so violent. And it was violence mixed with comedy, which the way it was done, what people were not used to. But okay, one of the last films to talk about, The Blair Witch Project. It's one of the most, like, the most important films to me, just in the way a film is marketed. It was a film that basically, it essentially was the first big successful viral marketing campaign. And Blair Witch, like, people didn't know, is it real, is it fake, we're not sure. That caused, like, I mean, so much, like,
free publicity.
Yeah, free publicity. Free publicity. And basically,
when,
like, because
when people are trying to sort it all out.
It was the first film that actually used the internet to its advantage, and the way it was promoted, and people, before they even saw it, like, were didn't know if it was real or fake, and wanted to go see it, and that, like I said, created free publicity, and they pretended that the actors were actually missing and were dead, and this was a real found footage thing, and essentially Blair Witch, it wasn't the first found footage film, but it established the found footage film, like the genre, as a money-making thing. And what I say with Blair Witch is that Hollywood didn't know how to take that, because it was so different. Because these filmmakers were like former student filmmakers from University of Central Florida in Orlando. They had a little bit of money. They used their home video cameras, and they made a film. And this is the film that also showed that you don't need millions of dollars in a marketing campaign with it, or a marketing from studio. You can actually make the film on your own. And so that changed the way, like they talked about in the video from the Academy, about how they were seen as like the faces of independent cinema for that time period. Like, you could do it too. You can go grab a camera and tell a story. But Blair Witch, with the viral marketing, studios really didn't start doing it well until The Dark Knight in 2008, and so like 10 years later, and they did.
Right.
They never.
And that's what we were talking about it a little bit in the pre-show of trans, you know, transmedia, right? Is the buzzword.
Yeah.
But where the story or the hype or the marketing crosses over, and you continue the story, or you begin the story, in the case of The Dark Knight, right? I mean, you begin the story or the clues in on the internet, in this transmedia format where it can cross over into the real world. You can get phone calls. You know, there's a story of like people having to go to like a bakery and request a cake. It's a story in a book actually called The Art of Immersion by Frank Rose. We'll put it in the show notes. And it's a fascinating book. They talk about the company that did the campaign for The Dark Knight, the transmedia campaign. And people would, one of the things that happened is, you know, they were like, on this particular day, like at 7 different bakeries around the world or something, people went in and asked for, they gave a name, right? And the bakery would give them a cake, and then the cake would start ringing. And they'd cut the cake open, and there'd be a phone, and the phone would lead them down towards more clues, right? It's just this great, like, I don't know, you know, it's like instantly you're like, yeah, I want to do that. That sounds awesome. But I think the thing that we were talking about in the pre-show that, to me, is really interesting, you know, we were saying, like, why haven't more, if the Blair Witch did it, why didn't more films follow suit, right? And it's a little bit of what we talked about, you know, number one, which is once you blaze that trail, you can't follow it exactly. You know, there's only one Blair Witch, and they got all the publicity and the free marketing. You can't show up to Sundance the next year with my project that's really just like the Blair Witch project. You know what I mean? It doesn't work that way. But the other key thing that I think is really interesting, more from the angle of transmedia or, you know, storytelling online to promote a film, is that their website, although simplistic, you know, in comparison to now, like, it was fundamentally something that enhanced the core question or reason to see the film, I guess. You know, it's this core thing of, like, is it real? Mm-hmm. And the problem with so many of these other campaigns is that they're limited. Like, because Blair Witch is so cheap, there's not a whole lot riding necessarily on it. I mean, they had all this hype, all this faith in the film, basically. So no one's breathing down their neck of, like, we got to get this right, boys. We got to make sure we get this right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's speculation. But with these huge summer blockbuster films, okay, it's like, okay, well, we need to do transmedia. Well, you can't do a lot in the story of the transmedia side on the internet that requires people to actually do it, because the main audience is actually the film. So then, because it can't be a central part necessarily in the core story, you're left to make, like, supplemental stuff, which is fine. It's just, it's different. You know, it's different than the Blair Witch was able to do. They were able to kind of continue playing off and build up this core idea that was central to the film. I don't know. There's just a lot of really interesting things about the way they promoted it.
Yeah.
And not many, I don't, you know, it's difficult for many films to repeat that. You know, it's just, it's a unique thing.
Yeah, and with Blair Witch, like, it was so interesting with Blair Witch. Like, I remember when Blair Witch came out. Like, I didn't go see it. I think I was like, oh gosh, I was probably 8, but just to...
No, you were like 3 years old.
I was 8, and so I watched wrestling growing up, so like... wrestling programming was like target audience for people who want to go see Blair Witch Project. So I remember, like,
really?
Yes, it, for some reason, what? Because it was predominantly males, like male, like younger males. That's the main demographic, like, for films. And so they were targeting toward, and just that older teen, like teenagers, early 20s, mid 20s, late 20s, that type crowd. I remember
you're that quadrant.
Yeah, quadrant everyone wants for. And I was like 8, and I was watching the. And I remember seeing Heather Donahue's, the actress. Like, I remember the apology, that's like kind of in the frame and kind of not in the frame. Her like crying to her parents and the other people's parents. I remember that at 8 years old, and I was like, "What is this movie?" Like, I remember how big it was back then. And then growing up, I've realized just how important it was and what it did. Like, just it's starting to hit of like how big this thing was. Because you can still go on right now to BlairWitch.com and see the website. It's still up.
Really?
Yes, you can still go see it.
Really?
Yes.
Here I go, you, Blair Witch Project.
I think it's BlairWitch.com is what it's called.
Oh, it's in Flash. Whoa, sorry. I guess now it's playing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. We'll have to put that in show notes. How weird is that? Man, nothing lasts long on the internet. That's forever.
Yeah, exactly. And like that shit, and that to me, I was like, that's how much it changed. They still have it up on there. It probably still gets people visiting. And it's just insane to me the way they did that.
Well, the most profitable film based on, like, ratio wise, based on its cost to make.
I mean, it made like close to $300 million worldwide, and it costs like $50,000 to make.
I'm sure they've picked up a lot more too over the years, just because of the status that it's achieved, like with streaming and sales of DVDs. I mean, it's just It's some ways sad, but I mean, you know, I'm happy for him, I guess. Like, it's just a crazy amount of money for what they started with.
And what I think,
started from the bottom. Now they're here, Brandon.
Yeah, but what I said, Blair Witch, and this is kind of the industry, and it's kind of, we talked about like the watershed moments of like there are films that are doing it before, and then finally this big film came. I think the industry takes a number, I say 10 years, just to give a good hard number, 10 years for it to actually catch up with itself, is what I say. Because you had the Blair Witch Project with found footage and viral marketing. To me, I don't remember really anything as big as for found footage until Paranormal Activity about 10 years later. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so everybody tries to copy,
yes.
But it's like you got to get all the. You have the original that changes everything, or yeah. You know, whatever. It's a turning point that we'll say, and then so if you had no idea it was coming, and you're at Sundance and you're an executive or whatever, you're gonna be like, oh crap, we got to make one of these. And even if you decided at that moment, that would still take you a couple years to get one out the door, right? Or maybe you could rush it, whatever. But a couple years, so you show up at Sundance a couple years later, it's not gonna be very good because you're missing the core element probably of what really makes it good. And then, you know, so you have to get all the copycats out of the way. And then finally, with Paranormal Activity, right? I mean, again, another movie I haven't seen. I understand what goes on. But, you know, that's where someone goes back to, like, what is it about this that works? And they find a way to turn it towards its current time. And things come in and out of trend or whatever, you know, out of popularity. But, yeah, maybe 10 years, maybe not, but... something along those lines of a cycle.
Yeah, why I say 10 years, because then we had the viral marketing campaign of Dark Knight, and it was kind of, I left, it was like, oh, it's the first of its kind. I was like, with like Paranormal Activity of the found footage, it's the first of its kind. No, it was done 10 years ago, but they used this, Paranormal Activity used the same exact techniques that Blair Witch used. Again, I remember when Paranormal Activity came out and like how people were talking about it at my high school. How they were talking about driving to Atlanta, Georgia, to go see it. But I remember Dark Knight and like when the Joker's picture was like was through a viral campaign of like you move the puzzle, you figure out the clues and you move the puzzle and it reveals this picture. I remember all that, and so like it took 10 years. And also too, to backtrack even to Batman in 89 was like that, and then Batman Returns came out in 92, and Batman Returns was considered too dark. Because it didn't make as much money as the first Batman. So they reverted back to campy, bright colors, really a lot more humor, more like the 1960s TV show. And then all of a sudden, that fails. Batman Begins comes out in 2005. And they're like, oh, we've been wanting this dark Batman. They're like, well, we were doing it 15 years ago. Like, it was the same exact thing. But yeah, it's just... The films, and there's one that I did, I'll bring it real quick because we're running out of time, Avatar. It changes the way Hollywood, the way they make things. It's so insane because we've actually been talking about Avatar at my school and just the things I'm learning about how Avatar changed the game. And also with Avatar, like, they were doing similar things before Avatar. They were doing Robert Zemeckis films with, like, Polar Express, and they were using the same type of technology, but it wasn't as... advanced.
They didn't have James Cameron.
And we could literally talk about each of these films in an hour. But yeah, so I'm going to ask this question. So who, in your opinion, is the most influential filmmaker that's changed Hollywood?
You didn't warn me about this. You didn't warn
Sorry.
Me. I think based on... no, I don't need a warning. I mean, based on what we've talked about, you probably... If we're talking Hollywood and we're talking about the films that... are in this time range, you probably have to go Spielberg, I think.
Okay.
Even though, you know, I wouldn't say that he's, like, my favorite by any means. Mm-hmm. I just think, you know, with all the films he's made and the ways that they've affected other filmmakers, just in the style of Hollywood, the blockbuster,
yeah.
The effects, the tone, and you know, yeah, Spielberg.
Okay, I would... It's a hard choice... Because I think without Jaws, you wouldn't have most of the films we've talked about. But Lucas, even though I've disagreed with some of the stuff he's done...
You can't... But I mean, you can pick what you want. I'm going to fight you on it just because it's like, okay, Star Wars, American Graffiti, but...
I'm going to
say... You got to talk longevity. I'll talk longevity. Think about how terrible the new Star Wars movies are. Okay. They're terrible.
My personal choice, I would pick Spielberg any day. Because, like, for sheer volume of films he's made that have changed the landscape, in my opinion, I would pick Spielberg. But Lucas, like, it's a trickle-down effect with Star Wars, how you go to Toy Story and Pixar, and you go to ILM and Jurassic Park and Terminator 2.
Yeah, yeah.
You could argue Lucas.
See, it's funny because I was going to pick Lucas, not even though I'm arguing against you. I was going to pick him because of the technology, because I thought you were, but then I thought you were going to pick Spielberg, so I, you know. I'm just, Brandon, we got to stop because I'm going to start quoting rap lyrics and I'm going to steal all your ideas. And, okay. You know, just the whole
thing. We'll end this right now, and we'll come back next week and talk about something else. Thank you guys for listening. I'm Brandon Sparks, and you can follow me. You can follow me on Twitter at @BCS_thefilmkid. Ben, go ahead.
Argue with him. Please, tell him why he's wrong.
Yeah, tell me some things.
Because he's wrong a lot.
Give me feedback. Thank you, Ben. You want to say your Twitter handle?
Yeah, started from the bottom, now we're here. I'm at SUITE22, sweet 22, on the Twitter webs. Send me your favorite rap lyrics and or suggestions for future episodes. I've got a back catalog, but definitely if we're in this frame of mind, we're going to have to do the golden age of American cinema, which is... late 60s, early 70s, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, all names we have not even brought up.
No, we haven't. Film history is so big. Well, it's 100 years or whatever. We could talk about anything, or talk about any of that stuff for hours on end. We hope this was informative.
That's why we're here.
Thank you guys for tuning in. This has been CineNation podcast brought to you by The Media Machine. You can like The Media Machine on Facebook. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.